Welcome to Cracked, the podcast, the program that slays the dragons of mental health by stripping away the shame, embarrassment, fear, and stigma. Because mental health isn't something that affects just some of us, it applies to all of us. Here to shine a new light on areas of mental health that often go unvisited are your hosts, Rebecca Shaper and Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome to Crack the Podcast, Slaying the Dragons of Mental Health, with me, Sandy Sedgebeer.
And me, Rebecca Shaper.
According to retired physician, speaker and best-selling author, Dr. Gabor Mate, trauma is a psychic wound that hardens you psychologically and then it interferes with your ability to grow and develop. It pains you and now you're acting out of pain. It induces fear and now you're acting out of fear. Trauma is not what happens to you. It's what happens inside you as a result of what happened to you. Today, Rebecca and I are delighted to welcome back internationally respected group and individual psychotherapist and author, Malcolm Stern, who's going to share his expertise and insights on healing and moving beyond emotional, physical, psychological, and generational trauma. Malcolm Stern, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Thanks, guys.
Malcolm, can you tell us about your knowledge or an experience with trauma?
Well, I have my own personal experience with trauma in that my oldest daughter, Melissa, took her own life in 2014. And I deliberately don't say committed suicide because people often talk about that when in fact what we're looking at is a choice that's made, not a crime that's there. But I think the trauma of what we go through as parents when we lose a child is something that actually settles in gradually and slowly and takes us on a journey. And it took that to shake me out of the place where I was working with other people's traumas and yet very unaware of my own. And I feel like I've become more aligned with my own journey through trauma. And therefore I'm able to work with people from a place of knowing rather than a place of philosophizing.
How did your... the way you deal with clients with trauma change then, you know, between before and after?
It changed a lot because I actually feel like it's almost like I earned my spurs in a way I didn't want to earn my spurs, but I did earn them in that way. And I feel like I'm trusted because I've been there. So I've got quite a number of clients who've got children who've committed suicide. I don't know how they came to my door, but somehow we seem to draw the people we need to draw. And what I recognize in that is that I'm able to speak to them from a place of sharing their wound. And that makes such a difference. I know when I was in my early days of therapy and having therapy myself and all of this sort of stuff, that I was coming from up here. And I think what that's done is it's brought me down into my gut, into my heart, and to the place where I can share. And in the main, I try not to take time when I'm working with a client to talk about my own story, but I will sometimes feed in that little bit. And I think I've probably got that right, that actually there's a sense of feeling safe because they're with someone who knows the territory, rather than someone who's trying to just hold space for them with the territory.
Yeah, that's a sense of them trusting you too. I like the fact that you in some way bring your own story because it makes it real.
Yeah.
It makes it real to them as well. So Malcolm, when dealing with trauma in patients and clients, how do experts define or characterize it? I mean, like there must be varying degrees of trauma. And how does treatment differ within the trauma and how does treatment differ when the trauma is acute or chronic? Sorry.
Yes. I think that's a good question because I think when it's acute, you're looking at actually finding a way of bringing that person back to themselves. There's no point in diving in if someone's in the midst of it. In fact, when I lost Melissa, I went to a therapist who'd been recommended to me, someone who was very, very good. but it was a waste of time my going there because I hadn't fully landed in the acuteness of my own trauma. So there's a sense that I'm working, tuning in. I'm not categorizing. I think we've got this overall term that's used in a big way now, which is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And originally, PTSD was recognized by the soldiers in World War I who were so shocked by the carnage and suffering they'd been through that they weren't functioning anymore. And so they coined this term PTSD. And I was talking to someone today about PTSD, and I thought, what would be valuable if we're going to categorize things? And I personally don't like categorizing too much. No one is, for me, a schizophrenic, a manic depressive, a bipolar person, but they are suffering with something that has been caused by their life circumstances or some glitch inside them that has kicked into play. So I had this quite interesting discussion today where what I recognized was that there are, if we're going to use the term PTSD, we could probably look at grade 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So at grade 1, it's like, you know, if you've been, for example, in the Nazi concentration camps, you don't come out of that the same as you went in. And that trauma takes a long time. My uncle, who was in the camps, said he didn't speak about his experiences for 50 years. Wow. And in the last year of his life, he spoke about it nonstop because he'd actually processed over the course of 50 years the suffering he'd been through, seeing his family killed in front of him, getting very close to starvation, having his life on the line a number of times and finding a way through it. But it took him a long time to be able to find his way. This wasn't with therapeutic help either, to find his way into his own trauma. So I think we've got to, as therapists, recognize what it is that they're going through and how we can be with them in that place to help them find their way to, it's almost like to the safe ground inside themselves, rather than to push them to re-traumatize by going back over the experience, which if you're not sufficiently grounded or sort of centered in yourself, can cause a lot more damage by re-traumatizing. Yeah. So we have to be careful of that. But I think there's a skill in the therapist of seeing what's asked of us when we sit with someone who's gone through something extraordinary. So, for example, I'm working with a woman at the moment whose son took his life a year and a half ago. And what she does quite a lot is she talks about something else. And I need to contain my impatience to want to get her in, because actually she's needing to make sure she's got safe ground that she can walk on alongside the process of what she's dealing with. And then at a certain point, I might say, well, what about, I'll name her son. What about, how's that been for you this week? Or something like that. So it's a simple input question. But I think there's a real sensitivity, because I think trauma can, it's almost, it can paralyze us in many ways.
Yes, it's almost, I'm sorry, Sandy, it's almost like it's avoidance trauma with her.
Yeah.
She was avoiding really what was.
Actually, what I would say in that is that the avoidance is an important part, that she knows that she can avoid it, that she doesn't have to be in it at all times, that she can function in the world. And so we have to honour the part that, but not to the level where we allow, it's not even a fair word to use, but not to the level where we collude with the utter avoidance, but find the place where there is an opening and then go through that crack.
Yeah, and having passion for yourself that, yes, okay, I realise I am avoiding this, but having compassion with yourself at the same time, because it'll be that vicious cycle. And I can see where the trauma left a huge imprint on her as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And it is a delicate process.
It's very delicate. I think, you know, what Gabor Mate has done, especially with the movie he recently made, is to bring trauma to the fore. And I think that we're looking now at actually that we're dealing with a lot of trauma. You know, we all have probably gone through trauma, I'm sure we all have actually, but gone through trauma. And then we found ways of resourcing ourselves. And one of the things I did when I wrote my book Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, which is da-da-da-da-da-da. One thing I did with that was to log the different structures that I'd used to deal with my own traumas as a way of saying, well, these are the structures I used. I didn't even consciously go, I'll do this, this, and this, but my knowledge kicked in so that I was able to deal with the trauma. So what we're doing is we're trying to educate ourselves and support each other in going through trauma. We've all gone through it, you know, it's like there are different levels.
Yeah, we've all gone through it in the last few years if we haven't gone through it before, which we probably have. I'm curious to know that, you know, some people seem to deal with trauma a lot better than others. Some seem to have resilience. What is happening to the body? And do you think, you know, when we have trauma, and do you think that people really are more resilient, the ones that deal with it better, or do you think they're hiding it?
I think there's a number of things. Sometimes they're more resilient. Sometimes they've learned some strategies to deal with it, and sometimes they're hiding it. And again, the job of a therapist is really to draw them to the place where they feel safe enough to open the door and take a look inside. But I think if the trauma is enormous, like the loss of a child, like I was listening to something this morning on the radio as I was driving about a guy who gradually went blind, but became an artist because he could still visualize in his mind gifts he'd had when he could see. And I was so impressed with this guy that actually he'd found a way to give his life meaning still, rather than saying, that's it, I'm screwed, I'm done. And, you know, he'd had a really lovely job before as a dental technician. He had a great skill in that sort of work, but he'd found something else. And again, I've been working with someone recently who was a very fit and able woman who suffered a serious illness and is bedbound most of the time, but she's found a way of using art and using writing and using colour as a way of dealing with a trauma. So I think sometimes we uncover and discover the strategies that we can use. We don't even know that those strategies are there, but we need support. I think that often we need support in that process that we can actually find our way through the forest of trauma.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. And like Sandy was saying, there are some people who can find that gift in their trauma to help others, and then there are some that can't. But it sounds like you have patients that are finding their way. I think that's remarkable. And that's. Anyway, that leads me to my next question: is there are different categories of trauma? Personal, cultural, generational, and intergenerational. Can you explain how the three of these differ?
Yeah, well, let me start with the intergenerational trauma, because that's something I've been uncovering in the last few years for myself. So I was working with a teacher called Thomas Hubel, who you may have heard of, who specializes in intergenerational trauma. And I remember being at a workshop where I suddenly got in touch with the fact that I was Jewish, and I got in touch with the fact that I was carrying some of the trauma of Nazism and of anti-Semitism. And I felt it from a very visceral space. It's one thing to think about it. It's another thing to actually go to those places. Mm-hmm. I also got in touch in the same workshop. It was one hell of a workshop for me, that one. But in touch with the same workshop with the loss of my daughter, and actually then finding the way of expressing like a wounded animal the pain that I was carrying as a result of this, which I'd very carefully sort of, you know, not consciously or deliberately, but I'd been able to sort of gloss over to a fair degree where I didn't go to the place of utter devastation in myself. So it was a thing I visited in small doses, but I went there wholeheartedly, full on. So intergenerational trauma in there was the personal trauma in there. And then there are other traumas as well. There's the trauma of being, for example, you have the trauma of being poor, of being impoverished and not being able to feed yourself or to feed your family or to be able to house yourself properly or to be able to find medical treatment. I remember when I was working in a medical practice in Lyme Regis many, many years ago, of having people sent to me who had no access to enough resources. And they were in trauma that didn't have a solution because they didn't have the money to find their way out. And there you go to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You've got a survival need. So at a traumatic level where you've got to survive, you've got to find whatever the resources you can to find your way through to survival. But once you've found the place of survival, then you start to look at the things that the trauma that's about developing ourselves and actually utilizing the trauma, recognizing the trauma, so that we can improve ourselves, that we can actually access the resources that will help us to find our way through what I would use before. I like this phrase, actually. I might use do a book on it. The forest of mental health.
Mm. Yeah.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that you know, we don't know the signposts. That's the thing. We have to learn the signposts. And the signposts don't become clear until we're working with it. So I look at my own signposts of dealing with my own personal trauma around Melissa's death. And I recognize that actually there were gifts given to me in that way. I found, interesting, the evening I'll give you an example of this, the evening that I found out that Melissa had died, I was in the end of running a one-year group. And my assistant, I came in sort of midway through the afternoon, having found out that my daughter had taken her life. And someone else took over the group, and he set up a grief circle, and I shared with the group what had gone on for me, because I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't pretend that hadn't happened or override that. But very beautifully, my assistant, who was a close friend and a lovely human being, spent the night with me and held me all night long. And I do believe that in that process of holding me, she actually stopped the trauma setting into my bones, into my being, the shaking and all the rest of it. I feel like I got this incredible gift for about 10 hours that night of actually having my trauma met and held. And that was the first of many gifts that I received. And Jung said everything is synchronicity. And there are synchronous moments in our lives, if we can spot them, which will give us what we need to deal with what we have to deal with.
Yes. Do you think that people who live through desperate times like war, prolonged situations, famine, pandemics, become inured to certain types of trauma and therefore less able to recognize that they are actually suffering from trauma?
Well, one of my favorite tracks in the world is Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb. And if you want to watch on YouTube, David Gilmour and David Bowie doing Comfortably Numb, it's such a brilliant statement that actually, I think for a lot of people, if we have enough comfort, we have our bread and circuses, as was said in the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, and I think we've got now, you know, the government are making sure we've got enough to eat and that we've got enough entertainment. You know, the Netflix and Amazon Prime have gone mad. You can watch stuff all the time. I think we can numb ourselves. And in the numbing of, I'm not saying numbing is bad, but I think that numbing, there's a certain point at which numbing crosses over so that we actually, as you say, inure ourselves. And I think that there is something incredibly powerful in facing and dealing with the traumas that confront us, and also the traumas that confront others that go with that as well. So, for example, my ex-wife just broke her leg, a dog ran into her, and she broke her leg, and I'm having to support her. I'm choosing to support her by walking her dog daily and making sure she's got food and all the rest of it. And it's like sort of meeting her in the place of trauma and not glossing over it with her, because it's painful for her. It's not, you know, there's some pain from the leg itself, but there's also pain in her life being sort of on hold for the next 6 weeks now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see where that'd be a healing situation for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I think we've got an opportunity to create better communities, mm-hmm. especially during the pandemic. We've seen how much suffering there is, both from getting ill, but also from losing the regularity of our lifestyle, losing the steps that we were taking as human beings. Automatically, I mean, I was traveling all over the globe, and it was like it was normal, you know, that I would go and teach in China, and I'd go and teach in Greece and in Spain, and suddenly all of that's gone, and there's a trauma in that as well, and finding ways of actually going, so how can I come to terms with this? who can I be in the light of circumstances around me having changed? And there's no doubt, I think, as human beings, that we are at a time of great crisis in the world's history. And I think we're dealing with that too. And I think it's becoming harder and harder to shut our eyes to that as we watch forest fires and tsunamis, yes, and climate change and all that. So there's trauma in the world,
yes,
around us, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. So that leads me to my next question for you, is do you see any common themes in the generational trauma? I was just curious.
I think what I can see is the potential for people to despair and the potential for me, you know, let's not talk about people. Let's look at it. We're people. So we're the ones who are in this as well. That right. There's a danger of us going, it's too much. I feel this incredible despair. I don't know what to do. And then we have to learn to resource ourselves, or I'm finding that I'm learning to resource myself. Interesting, I watched a very interesting documentary the other night on Netflix called Fantastic Fungi. I don't know if you know that documentary.
Yes, I watched it.
And, wow. And I realized that actually life on Earth is not going to finish.
And
it gave me such a high. Actually, yeah. Fungi are going to have survived for billions of years. They're going to survive, and they will create whatever the next phase of evolution is if we do find that as a species, we're in the final days on planet Earth as human beings.
Yeah, it was an amazing documentary. So when I'm out and about, I think about that film when I see it. Yes, it's incredible.
Do you think, I mean, I find that frustration fascinates me because I've seen people go to places that they would never normally go when they're extremely frustrated. And I think the world is frustrated right now because there are so many things that then, you know, we're not allowed to do, we can't do. And we're also learning that our personal power only gets us so far, that we don't have the sovereignty that we thought we had.
Very
nice. Yeah. So, I mean, do you think that's psychological trauma, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're being stripped naked, really, in lots of ways, that actually we haven't got the automatic resources that we took for granted before the pandemic. And so there is, and how do we deal with psychological trauma? Well, we adapt or we die. I mean, that's a very extreme statement, but it's like we have the invitation to adapt to being with what is. So I found during the first lockdown that I moved out of London and moved to Devon, and actually I'm living quite a different lifestyle, but I have thought to myself, I want to explore what it's like to live closer to nature. I want to explore what it's like to have part of the rhythm of my day be about walking by rivers and in on hills and through forests. Mm-hmm. And what I'm finding is that that's giving me something that I would never have taken if I'd carried on doing what I did before the pandemic. So I think there's opportunities that arise for us, but I don't want to be sort of all sort of Pollyanna-ish about it as well and go, oh, well, it's all great. It's not all great, it's tough.
No.
But we have to adapt and we have to get support in adapting. And I think this is the time where one of the chapters I've written about in my book is about creating a sangha, creating a spiritual community of like-minded others. And I think this is the time where we tune into and join forces with others so that we actually support ourselves in finding our way through the psychological wounds. For example, one of my sangha things that I have is a regular Monday morning hour with a friend where we call an inquiry for an hour, where we take half an hour each to talk about what's going on in our lives and for the other to reflect for us, not to say, oh, you poor thing, but to actually reflect what they see and what they see that perhaps we're missing and what are the themes of what we're going through. So we're supporting each other in being able to look at the psychology of the impact of our lives at this point in time.
And also, I think that's incredible because both of you are, I'm assuming, being very vulnerable when you do speak.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, one of the other things I'm doing, another friend of mine, I mean, I've got, luckily, I'm using the resources that are around, but another friend of mine is becoming a death doula. I don't know if you know that.
Yes, I know that.
So she's training to be a death doula, and she's using me as a coaching subject. So she's sending me a questionnaire every week, which she then debriefs me at the end of the week about at the physical, at the mental, emotional, practical, and spiritual level, what I'm doing to prepare for my death. Now, you could say that that's actually quite sort of deathist or sort of like, or sort of pessimistic, but actually we're all going to die.
Yeah.
Some of those questions are brilliant. I'm really having to think about my life. So questions like, who do you still need to forgive in your life? Who still needs to forgive you? What are you going to do about it? So things like that that come up. What, when you die, who would you like present there? And I realized, I was really touched as I wrote it, that for me, it's a non-runner that I want my children present when I die. You know, that's actually there. And I remember when my dad died, and I had my hand on his heart as it stopped beating. And it was one of the most precious moments in my life, because I was there in the face of death. So I think we're having to look death more squarely in the eyes in these times. And I think we're having to sort of face up to ourselves that actually we are, as I understand it, we are eternal beings, but we're having to see what this human existence has to educate us.
Absolutely. Point. And I think death is very, very sacred, because when my brother passed away, we all gathered around him and we played music. And I just think it's very sacred. It's not for everybody to be around someone who is dying, but to me, it was a gift for my daughters. And that was the first time they were able to witness what death was really like. And it was something they'll never forget. And it was beautiful. It was just quite a special time.
I mean, death can be full of suffering as well, but we don't know what our death will be like.
Right.
The reality is, what I realized is that I don't want anyone around me when I'm dying who's going to bullshit me, who's actually going to sort of like say, oh, there, you'll be all right. You know, you'll recover. And actually, I want people who meet me where I am. And I want to meet people where they are.
Yeah,
which is very important. It's interesting that you mentioned synchronicities earlier, because as you said, you know, we're seeing so much about death now, more books about grief and dying and a good death and what that looks like and death doulas, and also the same thing happening with all of the information that's coming out about trauma as well.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting, we've woken up to this stuff. You know, it's actually in our sphere now. I think we've got time. That we have created more time inside ourselves to look at life. And I've certainly seen that myself. And I wouldn't have chosen that. As conscious as I am of its need, I wouldn't have chosen it. But it chose all of us to actually have a slow down. And that's one of the pandemic.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Crack the Podcast with me, Sandy Sedgbeer, and Rebecca Shaper. And today we're talking about trauma and its ongoing effects on individuals, cultures, lineages, and generations with psychotherapist Malcolm Stern, author of the book Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, 10 Ways to Thrive, Even When It Seems Impossible. We'll be back after the break.
The Real Conscious Connection. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Worried about your friend but don't know how to reach out?
You
You can say how while you will get a fake tattoo. You can ask with an app if it works for you. You can chat with them in VR. It's all good if you think you should check in. Yeah, you should.
Whatever gets you talking.
Reach out to a friend about their mental health.
Whatever gets you talking.
Learn how you can help at seizetheawkward.org.
Welcome back. Malcolm, you spoke earlier about Thomas Hubel. You studied with him, and he's author of the book Healing Collective Trauma, A Process for Integrating Our Intergenerational and Cultural Wounds. Now, clearly, from what you've told us, you had some very powerful experiences. But what else did you learn from him that you hadn't known before?
He's a profound teacher. And it's hard to say I learned this or I learned that, but what happened is I had experiences in the time that I was studying with him. And those experiences color our beliefs. No one can take those experiences away. So one of the things I did, and I was the subject, there was a group of 150 people, where he had me work with him on my capacity as a group psychotherapist. And I have a very strong capacity towards instinct and compassion and the softer things. And he had me find my sword. And I can remember this moment really clearly, that I'd often balked from going to the difficult places where you challenge someone, and that's done from a place of love and connection. And he had a very broad, and it's interesting, I don't ever want to deify speakers, because through alternatives, I've seen all of the great speakers in this field. And we're all human beings. You know, there aren't any sort of, they're amazing. Yes, they've got amazing gifts, amazing talents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Thomas will have his own stuff, but he's a very profound teacher. And I think his understanding of intergenerational trauma, he's done a lot of work with Israelis and Germans and around the whole Holocaust issue. That's one of the areas that he's explored. But I think his work there is very guided and very gifted. And he has a real capacity, and I found him a profound teacher.
Yeah, he was one of the individuals that Mate Gabor interviewed in that film, the documentary. Yeah, and it was a very profound interview. I really thoroughly enjoyed listening to him. Mm-hmm. So we hear a lot about post-traumatic stress. And the phrases PTS and PTSD, are these the same things, or are there differences? And if so, how can we tell? What are the symptoms, and how can we help them?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I would reframe the whole approach to it. I think we like to categorize. We like to be able to say, well, that's we can put that away now, because that she's got PTSD or PTS. Mm-hmm. He is bipolar. So we can actually put them in a little category and then put them in a cupboard and lock them away. We don't have to worry about it anymore. And I think we're having to look beyond these diagnoses of what's going on for people and to recognize that, in effect, people have been deeply impacted by their life experience and may not be coping. And what is it that brings them to a state of coping? And yes, you know, I remember I worked with a guy in one of my groups who came in delighted one day because he'd had a diagnosis that he was ADHD, which then allowed him to sort of go, oh, well, it doesn't matter now how I speak to women because I'm ADHD.
And that was his excuse.
Yeah, he was getting a lot of flack from women about how he was speaking to them. But it's like, oh, I'm ADHD, you know, that's why. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you hide behind that label. Mm-hmm. I think there's an ease in hiding behind labels. Mm-hmm. And yes, of course, we've been impacted by things, and we have to respect that as well. But I think there's something about recognizing that we've had an experience which has altered us. And then we need to find the resources and the tools to find our way through that experience, rather than going, we can tuck it away neatly because now we know it was PTSD. And then we read the books on PTSD and that's it. I actually think that we are being challenged to grow beyond ourselves, especially in these times, I think that we are sort of in very perilous times in the world for the first time in, you know, in 60 years probably, where we are in times now where it feels like the world is turning and shaping. And I know Joanna Macy, who was very involved with Deep Ecology, said she talked at Alternatives about the time of the turning. And she said at the time of the turning, we're where we are now, we've had the industrial age, the agricultural age, and all of those ages. We're now at the time of the turning. And the time of the turning means there's one of two things that can happen. We can evolve as a species, so we actually find the resources to go beyond the suffering that we're going through and to find our way to a higher stage of evolution. Or we may be on the way out, and I don't say this lightly, as a species, but actually, either way, it's our task to keep feeding the positive, to keep making our contribution to life, because there is an enormous amount of trauma. And I know that one of my great teachers was Ram Dass, and he was a fantastic teacher for me. And I'm very grateful that I spent quite a bit of time with him. And he used to say that at one level, everything is perfect. It's all happening exactly as it should. At another level, there is suffering, and it's our task to deal with whatever suffering is in our path. So I think that let's go away from the labels to some degree, although I do think that sometimes if we've been so severely traumatized by, I remember one of my clients, he was in a car with his second wife, her daughter, and his son from his first marriage, and the car was hit by another car and burst into flames. And he only had 1 second to act, and he saved the daughter of his wife's daughter. And the father of that child reclaimed the daughter, and he lost his wife and his child and suddenly found himself alone. Now, he was in a place of post-traumatic stress. There's no question about that. I definitely got that. And he needed a lot of time and a lot of support before he could actually start to penetrate some of the veils that protect, because we get protected. You know, when my mother died, I felt like the shock didn't go boom and suddenly I'm a wreck on the floor. It goes in gradually, and life will educate us through the traumas that we have. And hopefully we can find wise companions along the path. We can also look into the sort of work that you guys are doing here on these podcasts, that actually we can educate ourselves.
I'm sorry, Sandy, I just got one quick question. Do you find in some of your patients who are severely traumatized, do they have addiction patterns?
Oh, often, yeah. Often, you know, there are all sorts of coping mechanisms, one of which is addiction. And we'll often find behind addiction is trauma. So sexual addiction, drug addiction, alcohol, there's trauma behind it. But we're avoiding, like the plague, we're avoiding. And the plague has arrived, so we can't avoid it anymore.
Right.
So I think there yes, of course, there are strategies. But some of them are not very healthy. Like addiction is not necessarily a healthy strategy. But sometimes there's a crutch that's needed. Sometimes we will need to use medication or something that will numb the pain for a while till we feel able to deal with it.
Yeah.
Malcolm, I want to talk about how how we can get beyond trauma, how people can deal with it. What are the best strategies? And there's one thing that many years ago, before I was studying NLP, I read a book by Leslie Cameron Bandler, and she was using an NLP technique to help rape victims in the immediate aftermath and helping them somehow distance themselves from it and take away some of that immediate trauma. Do you think that modalities like that are actually beneficial? Is there something there about, distancing yourself?
They are beneficial, but there isn't a one size fits all. So for some people, that would be a really powerful way of dealing it. I've watched, we put on Richard Bandler, who is one of the founders of NLP, and he talked about sort of putting things on a screen and then shrinking the screen. I found that a very useful exercise. So I think we have to look at what are the techniques that are out there Yes, that's useful, but we've also got to learn to resource ourselves with what it is we need to do. And so for me, one of the things is, A, really important, is find community that can support us and we can be supportive in. It's not like we can drop into a community that's going to support us, but that we can create friendships that are honest and honourable, and we're practicing skills like authenticity and other areas like that. Two is make sure that we feed ourselves well. And I'm not just talking food, I'm talking about music, I'm talking about entertainment, I'm talking about literature. You know, I remember reading Hermann Hesse many years ago, who was my absolute hero in terms of, I think he's chronicled in fiction, the spiritual journey. I found that so valuable to be able to use that as a map for spotting what was going on in my own journey. So I think that we right now we're looking for resources to help us manage these times, no matter what it is we're dealing with. And there's all sorts of other things. We can meditate. We can make that a daily practice. But actually, we're slowing down. We're tuning in. We're actually feeling what wants to come through us, rather than busying ourselves and trying to avoid pain.
Yes. Do you think it's possible for empaths to pick up on others' trauma and think it's theirs, or take it on as their own? Have you ever come across this with some of your patients?
Most certainly, yes. I think I consider myself empathic, an empath. I consider my daughter Melissa an empath as well, and I do think that we can very easily pick up and carry each other's traumas. And we have to find ways of dealing with that as well. You know, I used to be dealing with something that was very painful and difficult, like this chap I described earlier, whose whole family were incinerated in one moment, and his life changed in that moment forever. That it's quite hard to let go of that. But there, we have to find ways of distancing ourselves without shutting ourselves off. So it's a delicate and subtle process we go through. And one of the reasons Gabor Mate is so powerful is because he went through enormous trauma himself as a child. So he knows the territory for himself, and he's not healed from it. But part of what he's doing with the work that he's doing is that he is healing himself as well as offering this to heal others. And I feel that's what I'm doing. I'm healing myself by doing the work I do. I'm actually dealing with my own traumatic wounds.
And that speaks for me as well with the documentary and the book and doing this. Through the trauma I lived with growing up, and it's my tool as well. I mean, there's always stuff that creeps up, but I know I have the tools to be able to take care of it. And
you will have developed those tools over a period of time. You wouldn't have gone, well, here's the toolkit, so I better just sort of pull them out and then just, you know, choose tool number 4 or 5 or 7 to deal with this situation. You will have learned on the job, as it were, that actually you started to resource yourselves.
Yeah, it was pings. It's like, oh, okay, now I know why I feel this way. You know, just doing the filming or writing the book or whatever, it's like these pings that would come up. Did you feel pings with your daughter when she died by suicide? Were there any pings that you had?
I think it shattered my world to some degree. And I say to some degree because I didn't fall apart, although it was very difficult to hold it together. But I think that I had to find a different worldview because I could no longer fit who I was into the container of who I was becoming as a result of the trauma that I'd been through. So yes, it did have the pings that went with that as well. But it also drew me closer to other people who'd been through similar experiences and feeling like I could stand with them and I could be a friend or a therapist or someone who could actually dare to be with them. And interestingly, I was in a men's group at the time that I was, I've been in men's groups forever, you know, but I was part of a peer men's group at the time where Melissa died. And there were two of the men in the group who found it very difficult to be with my pain. It wasn't that easy to talk about it all the time. I could see that they were just, whoa, I can't handle that. And I left that group because that group wasn't going to feed my soul. So we have to find the environments that can handle us as we go through this. And when I talk about the, you know, the, the dying process, we have to create, if we're lucky enough to be able to do it, the environment for ourselves, which is going to be nourishing, which is going to make death an adventure and a journey rather than something that just happens to us without our ever having considered it.
Mm. How would we recognize when someone's traumatized? I mean, obviously, there are some clear signs in some people, but in others, it might be a lot more subtle. Are there common things to look out for?
I think where someone feels, so at a subtle level, I think where someone feels like their words don't match the feelings that you're getting from them. So where you find dissociation, I think you've got one of the subtle clues there that says something's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to go in with a battering ram as a therapist or even as a group therapist. You want to say, you'll invite them to try and go down a little bit deeper. At another level, people can be, I remember working with a woman many, many years ago who had been multiply raped as a child and passed around her family to be sexually abused. And so anytime anyone touched her, she would, there would be a sort of like an absolute sort of like, you know, couldn't handle it. And again, that's a very subtle process of helping her to gradually be able to deal with that and to recognize that this is not the same. So sometimes it's a very delicate operation where you're gradually weaving your way in with someone. Sometimes it's a challenge to say, you're angry, I don't feel anger. You're talking that you're sad, I don't feel sadness. And to learn to trust yourself when you're in relationship with these people, whether as a friend or as a therapist, to trust yourself. Not that you're going to challenge them for the sake of your ego being pumped up, but that you're challenging them from a place of recognizing something doesn't fit. And that's what we're looking at. When something doesn't fit, often something else is going on.
Yeah.
Yes. At a more obvious level, by the way, you can have someone who bursts into tears all the time because actually that trauma is uncontainable for them. And again, then we have to learn to build containers with each other and to find ways of supporting each other.
Do you think we can, should help ameliorate trauma for someone, or is that best left to a professional?
I think we, as Ramdas says, we deal with what comes in our path. So I was working the other day, and this was a magical moment. These rarely happen in groups, but this was this once in a blue moon moment where a woman had, I didn't know this at the time, had decided to commit suicide, had decided to take her own life. She stockpiled the drugs that were necessary to do that, and she was ready to choose her moment. And she'd come to the group very dissociated. So I noticed that something was going on. And then I invited her to share. And she started to speak. And I said, come into the center of the circle. And she came into the center of the circle, and the group are around her listening to her. And she started to speak, and she said, I don't think I should be standing. I think I should be on my knees. And so she went into her knees. And I intuitively went down next to her on her knees and put my arm around her, checking first of all, of course, that it was okay to touch her. But I put my arm around her, and suddenly she burst into tears, leaned into me. And I said, how old are you? She said, 2. Mm. And she talked about this little ball of snot and shit that she was. She was abused as a child, that she was maltreated as a child, and that trauma had gone with her through it. She'd found some fantastic coping mechanisms. She was a mental health professional. But she had, this trauma had gone with her all the way along the way. And what happened is the whole group responded to her trauma. And that evening, she sent a picture, a video of her flushing the medication down the loo. She rang me about 3 weeks later and said, it's not there for me anymore. I will never take my own life. Something got healed in that moment. Now, I'm not saying, wow, I healed it, but what I'm saying is that in that moment, something magical was able to happen because the synchronicity was accurate. But I think as a one-to-one, if you're standing, you're a lay person, and someone says, well, I think you're committing suicide, you can't say, well, okay, well, how old are you? And well, I think there's a danger in being an amateur psychotherapist with people. But what we can do is give them our love and give them our hearts and make a space where they can speak into, should they so choose.
Yeah, you were given, and she felt that. And yeah. That's a great story, beautiful yeah. story.
I was moved beyond all belief. And yeah. when she rang me about 3 weeks later, she was just so delighted. She said, it's like that little, I've let in my little girl now. She's no longer something I want to kill off. And that's what she wanted to kill off, was the traumatized 2-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, what I said at the beginning that Gabor Maté had said about it's not the trauma, it's, you know, how your body, yourself is reacting to that trauma, what it's doing because of it. And also it's your mind as well, how your mind is responding to that. I mean, if we can somehow change our perception, which is, must have happened for that woman, you know, somehow she got the message that she wasn't, you know, a ball of snot. She wasn't shit. She was, you know, a human being that people cared about. It's that perceptual shift, isn't it, that
yes.
makes a difference.
Well, you know, I often say that it's not what happens to us. It's how we respond to what happens to us.
Yes.
And I think that... we are going to be met with trauma in our lives, and yep. we have to learn to handle it, and we have to become bigger in ourselves to find the resources to deal with it. As you said before, Rebecca, that you know you've dealt with the death of your brother. You know that's something you would have had to have found resources, as I had to find resources, and as this woman I was talking about just a little while ago found the resources where she was no longer that 2-year-old ball of snot.
Yeah.
And it usually leads all the way back into the childhood.
It's pretty much always.
Do you feel that way? Do you feel the trauma? I mean, of course, there could be trauma in a person who may say they've never had trauma, but they really have. You know, have you dealt with that before?
Well, I remember doing a retreat of therapists that Ramdas ran back in the 80s. He did a meditation on grief, and there were people sobbing all over the floor. I think there were 40 of us in the room, and there were, you know, 2/3 of the people were sobbing on the floor, and I was sitting there smugly feeling, well, I don't have that grief. And then he said something very magical. He said, and for those of you who aren't in feeling that, your grief is the fact that you're so far divorced and removed from your grief.
Yeah.
And
yes.
That was a moment for me. It got me.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Profound statement. Yes.
Yeah. We've only got about 2 minutes left, unfortunately. Rebecca, is there any last questions you want to ask Malcolm?
There's a lot, but...
there always is.
Yes, there always is. I just really appreciate you coming back on and talking about this. I think it's so important because as we... go into 2021, 2022, I think people dealing with trauma, it's going to be more in the forefront. Yeah. And I'm sure you're seeing it as well in your therapy sessions. And what would be the most powerful tool you could tell people? What, as far as the best way to deal with trauma? I know that's a huge statement and question, but can you sum it up in a
Yeah, I'm sure I can.
In a minute?
I would say gather your tribe around you and learn to commune with your tribe. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I would take the Dalai Lama's brilliant statement, my religion is kindness, and see how that can be activated in our lives.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Malcolm, one of the things about this show is mostly we have American guests on, and I think we've only had a few English guests. Would you please, before we close, just say a very short piece about Compassionate Mental Health, which is an organisation that I know you're involved in and is in Britain. I don't know if they've got something similar in America, but please tell us something for our English viewers.
Well, this woman, Bridget Bowen, created an event called Compassionate Mental Health after she'd been diagnosed as incurably insane at the age of 24 and was expecting to spend the rest of her life in mental homes. And she set up this, and she went to Thich Nhat Hanh's retreat at Plum Village and studied Buddhism and studied meditation and found her way through it. She set up this organization called Compassionate Mental Health. One of the things we do in that is compassionatementalhealth.co.uk, so that's the website. And she set up these gatherings, which were normally 3 or 4 day gatherings, where people would come. One of the rules was no labels. No one is schizophrenic, bipolar, or anything else, but we're here together. And the clinicians and the people who were also being treated for mental health issues would gather together. They weren't separate. They weren't the experts and the sponges, but actually we together were exploring the nature of mental health. And I learned so much. I thought I was going there to teach people, and I was going there to be educated.
That's wonderful. I'm afraid we're out of time now. That's all we have time for. Malcolm, thank you for joining us again.
Yes, and thank you for adding value to people's lives too.
Yeah, that's very sweet of you. Thank you, and I love working with you guys, so really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
You can learn more about Malcolm Stern's work, programs, sanghas, and his books at his website, malcolmstern.com, and that website for Compassionate Mental Health has .co.uk on the end of it. That's it. You can also download a free excerpt from Malcolm's book, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, on the website on Malcolm's page. So that's it for us this week. See you in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah. Goodbye. Thank you again, Malcolm.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you.